I am the Assistant Dean for Research and a Professor of Nursing at Hunter College School of Nursing. I'm also a pediatric nurse practitioner and for several decades have been taking care of adolescent girls in New York City, providing reproductive health care to them, and which is the reason that this issue of reproductive health policy has really become so near and dear to my heart. I'm also writing a book on the topic, and so some of what I'm speaking about is not really nursing, you'll see, but we go afield into different areas. But the topic is the intersection, which is something we're not hearing a lot about, the intersection between reproductive health policy and reproductive health. And I have no disclosures. So when we think about health policy, let's think about who makes health policy in effect, who's making health policy, particularly in the area of reproductive health, and who should be making health policy. And is health policy, as it's being enacted today, evidence-based? And what happens when health policy is based on belief and isms rather than on data? So reproductive health policy, as we all know, is the poster child for what happens when policy is predicated on belief and not on data. And even some earnestly held beliefs that people have about women's health policy, particularly in the areas of abortion and contraception policies, are not based on accurate religious history, but rather they're based on fiction. For example, little quiz here, true or false? Evangelical Christians have always supported a pro-life, that is an anti-abortion position. And if you, you know, are not in a coma, you notice in the newspapers and what you're hearing that of course they've always felt that they've always been pro-life. But in fact, that's absolutely not the case. And as recently as June of 1971, which is only 40 years ago, but before Roe v. Wade was passed in January of 1973, at the Southern Baptist Convention, and I'm quoting here, they called upon Southern Baptists to work for legislation that will allow the possibility of abortion under such conditions as rape, incest, clear evidence of severe fetal deformity, and carefully ascertained evidence of the likelihood of damage to the emotional, mental, and physical health of the mother. Remember those words as we go through this little talk. They were concerned about the emotional, mental, and physical health of the mother. And that all changed after Roe was decided for reasons having everything to do with money and power and absolutely nothing to do with health, and certainly nothing to do with morality. Okay, another true-false. Abortion has always been a sin in the Catholic belief system. No, it has not. Until the mid-1800s, an abortion before quickening, that is, an abortion before the time that the mother felt fetal movement, was not considered a murder. Therefore, it was not a sin, and it was okay. Again, the change in belief was based on political exigencies within the Vatican at that time, not on moral considerations. And yet today, more and more states and the federal government are passing policies limiting access to contraception as well as abortion, based on the erroneous belief that abortion has always been considered baby killing, and that some forms of contraception are abortifacient, so women in some areas have difficulty even accessing contraception. And the result is that maternal and child health have suffered over the years because of this. What the data show? The data show us that there are critical predictors of poor pregnancy outcomes, that is, predictors of infant and maternal death. The first one is the age at which women conceive. When women conceive too young in their teens or too old in their 40s, that is an increased risk, and that's a higher risk pregnancy for both the mother and the child. The second risk factor is the length of the interval between pregnancies. Less than 2 years between pregnancies presents a risk to both mother and baby. And the third is the number of children a woman bears. Fourth or higher order births present risk, again, to both the mother and the baby. So let's look at our ranking on maternal mortality in the United States. Right now, we rank 39th globally in maternal mortality. behind nations such as Slovenia, Albania, and Qatar. Our maternal mortality ratio has actually increased since 1990 from 11.5 to 16.7 per 100,000 pregnancies. Our ranking on infant mortality is similarly abysmal. The United States international ranking in infant mortality fell from 12th best, which we were in 1960, to 23rd, to 29th, and currently 30th in 2005, behind nations that are less developed than we are and certainly less wealthy than we are. There are also enormous racial disparities in infant and maternal mortality. The infant mortality rate for non-Hispanic blacks is more than double that of whites, 13.4 per 1,000 live births for black infants compared to 5.7 per 1,000 for whites, and actually 5.5 for Hispanics and Asians. Maternal mortality similarly has very, very high racial disparities. Our total maternal mortality ratio in this country is 12.7 per 100,000 live births. Among non-Hispanic white women, it's 10.5. Among non-Hispanic black women, it's 28.4. It's abysmal. And among Hispanic women, it's actually lower at 8.9 per 100,000. So there are complex reasons for these racial disparities, and some of those reasons may be physiological. People are trying to do research right now and tease out, are there certain susceptibilities among African American or black women that are different, that predispose, and there are some thoughts in terms of vasculature and susceptibility to infection and other things. But primarily the reasons are social, poverty and stress. In fact, I was just before this presentation, I was at a luncheon for the maternal child health section, and an award recipient there was talking about the fact that you cannot, within 9 months, even providing people with good care, during the 9 months of pregnancy, you can't erase all the damage that's been done to people before they got pregnant in those many years. He was similarly bemoaning our high rates of infant and maternal mortality in this country. So poverty and stress are clearly contributors. And among, you know, when you're poor, you don't have access to care. And you, that means you also don't have access to reproductive health care. You cannot get contraception. Now, I was looking at this, and I was just wondering whether there was any data, if we could look at how easily a woman could access reproductive health care via Medicaid in certain states. Certain states, it's very easy. Other states, not so much. Does that relate to infant mortality in that state? And what I found was that a state's failure to pay for comprehensive contraceptive services for poor women through the Medicaid program is a statistically significant predictor of a higher infant mortality rate in that state. But that shouldn't be surprising, because we know that if pregnancies are too frequent, too closely spaced, or in moms who are too young or too old, it's a risk factor, so clearly it is. Put another way, the odds of a state being among the worst 20 states for infant mortality are 5 times greater if the state does not provide comprehensive Medicaid payment for contraception. Not providing women with contraception is hurting infants. And even after infancy, there's data to show that large family size and unplanned pregnancies, I should rephrase that to say large family size that includes unplanned pregnancies and births, also place children, so past that neonatal or infant period, the children are at risk for physical abuse and neglect. Therefore, policies that are aimed at improving maternal, infant, and child health should involve facilitating access to contraception and, by extension, abortion when contraception fails. However, as you all know, there's been an onslaught of policies that are detrimental to women and children. Nationally, for example, just recently, the House passed H.R. 358, which allows hospitals to refuse to provide a woman with emergency abortion care, quote, even if she were to die without it. And that is the conscience clause. If there's somebody working in that emergency room who doesn't believe in abortion, they shouldn't be required to provide abortion care, even if that patient is hemorrhaging to death, is seizing, whatever the problem is, and she needs an abortion. Now, I actually recently read an article by Representative Joe Pitt, who was the person who wrote this legislation, and he said, we're not letting them kill women in emergency rooms. What that means is that people who don't believe in abortion will no longer be able to work in emergency rooms. But what if you are a woman and you live in New Mexico and there's one hospital that's available to you, and there happens to be somebody there who doesn't believe in abortion? Then they don't have to provide care to you, and you don't have time to drive 200 miles to find another hospital where they will. And that is the reality of women's lives in this country. I come from New York City. There are lots of hospitals, but in many parts of the country, there aren't. Now, so it's okay to let women die in the emergency room, according to this law, and yet when we go back to what the Southern Baptists said before Roe was passed, remember that they said we should allow abortion in case of rape, incest, fetal abnormality, and just evidence of the likelihood of damage. The likelihood of damage, not the certainty of damage. The likelihood of damage to the emotional, mental, and physical health of the mother. What a turnaround. And actually, interestingly, the Southern Baptist's most deeply held tenet is separation of church and state. There's the kingdom of God and the kingdom of man, and the kingdom of God should have nothing to do with the kingdom of man, nor should it dictate their policies. And I've heard evangelical scholars speaking, and they say that. Things like gay marriage, why not? Who am I to say no? In my church, no. In the world, why not? So it's just been so turned upside down, and we've really gotten so away from what's really real, what was really real to them. Okay, further, attempts to defund Title X, the government's main family planning program for low-income women, it doesn't fund abortion. On the state level, the Center for Reproductive Rights compiled data on recent reproductive legislation and found certain themes, including biased counseling, policies which compel, at the risk of being put in jail, compel physicians to provide patients with state-mandated information before a patient is permitted to obtain an abortion. Information which, by the way, may not be medically accurate, but nonetheless, that's what the physician has to say. We need to lie to our patients. Mandating medical procedures, requiring women to look at an ultrasound. Nobody does abortions without an ultrasound. You need to know where that pregnancy is and before you're going to do an abortion. But this is requiring women to look at the ultrasound. One state is considering legislation to require the mother to listen to the fetal heartbeat in hopes that she will not terminate that pregnancy and will go on to have an unwanted pregnancy, an unwanted birth. They have imposed ridiculous requirements for abortion settings, making them essentially like a hospital operating suite, and that's not realistic. Abortion, by the way, is the safest procedure that's performed in the United States today. It's as safe as a penicillin injection. It does not present unusual damage. Idaho, I just pulled out some. There are so many laws that have been enacted recently. Idaho took steps to reduce access to a range of reproductive health services this year by passing a law allowing healthcare professionals to refuse to provide or assist in abortion care. And they define emergency contraception as an abortifacient. And even in New York City, I've had several patients who became pregnant because a pharmacist wouldn't fill their prescription for emergency contraception. And it was really devastating, of course, as it is to any woman. New York has since changed its law. If they don't provide emergency contraception, there has to be a statement in the pharmacy saying, we do not provide Plan B. Texas passed a measure requiring doctors to perform sonograms on women seeking abortions and to describe to them what they see and hear. The attack on Planned Parenthood, I'm sure everybody here is familiar with. And Planned Parenthood, I'm sure there are people who work in Planned Parenthood, provides so much needed care, not just to women, by the way, but also to men. And governments in New Hampshire, North Carolina, Indiana, Kansas, Wisconsin, Texas, and New Jersey have voted to cut or eliminate funding for Planned Parenthood. Texas cut funding for family planning from $111.5 million to down to $37.9 million, while increasing funding for anti-choice organizations, which are not healthcare organizations. Therefore, policy designed to promote maternal, infant, and child health would provide women with access to contraception and abortion. If your goal was to improve health, you would provide access to contraception and abortion if you looked at the data. And that would decrease the risk factors for poor maternal and infant outcomes. Public health advocates do not need to take sides in this debate. We should simply advocate for policy to be based on evidence. It's what we do in every other field. It is not a matter of pro-life or pro-choice. The data should drive us to a policy that is pro-health. And by way of full disclosure, I am the mother of six, the grandmother of 12, a huge fan of people having children, but only when they want their children. Those are two of mine right there. Thank you.